So thank you very much for this great talk. I'd like to now invite all the speakers up to the panel. Please, Dr. Zurkali, maybe come here, and then we'll have questions from the audience. And I'm not sure if Phil or Eli or... Okay, excellent. Phil is here. So I would like to begin, while the other people are coming up, to ask Dr. Power, what about... atrial appendage ligation for atrial fibrillation. Is there any role of that in dialysis patients?
I don't know.
Okay.
As I said, I think our understanding of how best to manage AF in dialysis patients and whether it actually leads to a reduction in stroke risk is in its infancy. We've inferred a lot about our practice from retrospective and associational studies, which is why I make my point of trying to, I think, come together as a community to finally clinch this issue.
Is anyone in London doing that?
Not yet.
Okay. Good.
May I make a short comment?
Of course. There's a microphone.
You did a very nice review. You missed just one paper by our group, which was published in 2010 in the Journal of Hypertension. I'm quoting it just not for self-complacency, but because it supports some points you made, that is the relevance of classical risk factors for stroke in dialysis patients. And there is another element that emerged in that study, 2010 it was published, that hemoglobin was directly associated with the incidence rate of stroke. 1 gram higher hemoglobin predicted a 28% risk excess for stroke.
Thank you for that.
And just before we go to the audience question, I had one more question from Albert. What about the whole platelet story? Is that just over? The high ESA dose may give thrombocytosis, and this may be causing the a higher risk of stroke.
I don't know if that story is really over. I think what I was trying to illustrate in a couple of sort of snapshot slides with the graphs is that traditionally we've looked at this very much as a risk factor present, absent sort of way. And I think the importance of treating some of these variables as continuous variables in mediating stroke risk is actually much more illustrative. I think the point is made with hemoglobin, and I demonstrated almost, dare I say, a skewed U-shaped graph with Hb as a factor. Now, whether platelets as well, so the total platelet count, may play a role, I think is speculative. I don't know of any data pro or con in dialysis populations. And I would say the same is true for blood pressure. And I think we just need to be a little more canny in the way that we analyze the data that we have in trying to untangle this if we're going to use a retrospective approach. In not just trying to look at characteristics of our cohort at time zero and then trying to figure out how that mediates stroke risk, but actually thinking about what we do to people over time and whether that, in fact, mediates stroke risk. So have a much more longitudinal way of assessing risk.
So maybe could you please identify yourself and...
Dr. Onibo here. This goes to the debaters. I don't know if you can answer it or somebody else in the audience could. There's some story out there that in the early 70s, 71, that physicians recommended in the U.S. 5 daily treatments a week, but that, in quote, the economists in Washington thought that it was too expensive to run, and they went for it 3 times a week. Is that true or not?
Phil, maybe you have some comment on this?
No, not on that, but I think the general point you're raising is very good, and I would suggest if we go to a more recent period, when EPO was approved, for example, I think it was the first time in America that the federal government was in the practice of medicine. Prior to that time, general practice was that Medicare would pay for whatever was generally accepted procedures. But in the case when EPO was approved in the late 80s, it was very clear that the federal government in the form of Medicare and the FDA were in coming down with certain criterion and so forth. And I think it was very obvious that in setting, you know, the upper limit of the hematocrit or the hemoglobin would be and so forth, I think that was very economically chosen. So I don't know about the earlier period, but I do think that this issue, I mean, certainly in this field, track the history of EPO and how that's been handled gives you a very good handle on, I would say, a conflict of interest that the federal government has in a way, because they are making choices about hemoglobin levels and so forth. And it's clearly economically driven. And on that point, going back to the other debate, one of the things the patient had suggested as something they might buy was higher EPO. Now, people are very quick to say, well, there are these cardiovascular risks and so forth with higher doses of EPO, et cetera. But I would suggest that what has never taken place, which needs to take place, is when you meet with a patient, it seems to me that you should be saying, okay, here's this EPO, and it has risk, but all medications have risk, and a patient might be willing to trade off a higher hemoglobin against some cardiovascular risk. I don't know that anybody's ever quantified that, but I suggest that is the real choice that people should be making. I had a chief of, or a man who worked for me who many years, who's now had kidney failure, and it's interesting when he talks about hemoglobin, and his hemoglobin gets down just a point. I mean, he is very upset, and I think very clear that if he were given a choice, he would be much more willing to work up in the range of 13 or 14 or something like that to avoid the possibility of this fall. But at any rate, the point is, patients do make choices.
Hi, I'm one of the fellows from Buffalo. I have a question for Dr. Power. Could you throw some light on permissive hypertension in acute stroke patients, dialysis patients? Is there some cutoff that we need to look at, or is it the same as in general population?
Well, I wish I could point you to some evidence. I can't in dialysis populations. I think it's fair to say that at the moment, it's probably reasonable to apply the general population paradigms in terms of acute blood pressure management in hemodialysis patients. There are some useful guidelines, so to speak, published by Andrew Davenport, that you will find. I think one of them is called Practical Guidance on Dialyzing a Patient with Acute Brain Injury, and he's since published another one looking at patients with acute intracerebral hemorrhage. And I think the key point to draw out of that is how important it is to maintain systemic blood pressure stability peridialytically, and to try to minimize the osmotic insult associated with hemodialysis on the acutely injured brain. Now, unfortunately, most of the studies were done in patients with traumatic brain injury rather than a stroke event. So I wouldn't rush in to say that it's exactly the same situation, but I think it seems intuitively reasonable to keep perfusion pressure up, not down, to dialyze little and often, to minimize the URR that you deliver with each dialysis, and certainly to try to keep fluid shifts to a minimum as possible. So yes, I think I would allow some permissive hypertension in acute brain injury, certainly for the first 72 hours.
Dr. Titze, go ahead.
Jens Titze from Vanderbilt. I have a question to Dr. Held. I have a question on the basic equation, and I think I simply didn't get it at all. So, to my understanding, the point was that if there's private money in dialysis or more investment, more money, there would be better care, right?
It depends on what that money is put towards. I mean, I think that, one of my fundamental ideas is that we don't know a lot what patients want. I told the story of what these patients wanted. Certainly improving quality of care is certainly possible, but I don't think it's restricted to that. I gave the example of perhaps a large body mass man who, you know, maybe his physician thinks 4.5 hours or 5 hours is a good idea. And they're in a dialysis unit that does 3.5 hours.
And then the question was whether it is ethical when private money is spent for improvement, right?
That was the question.
So it was about the ethics.
I mean,
yeah, that's the moment where I simply do not understand it. Because if I were a dialysis patient tomorrow, having the choice being treated in the United States of America or in Europe, I would be in Europe tomorrow. I would go to a system where I would get 4.5 hours of dialysis as a dialysis patient, and that actually would cut, and that treatment would cost, well, would cost less than it would cost here.
Where?
In Europe.
I don't believe it.
You don't believe it?
No.
Well, okay.
You see,
you could ask Camille Scali about that because I do not know the detailed numbers there. But I have the impression that as a dialysis patient, I would get much more healthcare delivery per dollar in Europe than I would get here.
Oh, I think on that point, you're correct. And I think, my basic point, if you recall, is the saying that there has been a fixed low price, and there are consequences of that. And it is certainly the case that people treating dialysis patients have a very strong incentive to minimize a lot of things. And one of them, the most expensive thing in America is hiring labor, and the most expensive thing in a dialysis unit is extending the dialysis treatment time. So we should not be surprised that there's a lot of economic pressure on American dialysis units to come up with, cost-saving things. In fact, I would say one of the most amazing things, if you think about treatment in America, and all the changes that have occurred over these last 42 years, every one of them, with the exception of EPO, I would suggest, is a cost-minimizing change. And some of them have worked out. Some of them haven't. There was a period when the thought KT was a linear relationship, and so we can push up K, drop T to 2.5 hours. I suspect a lot of patients died as a consequence of that. But I think it was a consequence of the financial system, and that's why you need these assurances of quality and so forth. But why Americans are more focused on this than the Europeans, you might start by the fact that we have a treatment rate that is twice anywhere in Europe. Are you aware of that? We have twice the treatment rate in the United States than occurs in Canada. The only country in the world that has a higher treatment rate is in Japan. And they have very good outcomes, by the way. I'm not sure I've answered your question, so give me another stab.
I'm afraid that there's no answer to that. Well, in general, except for that, I believe if we're focusing on ethic, it's a little bit difficult to just focus on one country and forget the worldwide comparison.
Well, I think that's a very good point. I don't know that the U.S. Medicare program has an obligation to export dialysis treatments around the world, I will say that if anybody is going to export dialysis around the world, it is going to be people like FMS and DVA. I mean, they're both expanding.
Let's ask our resident European dialysis expert, Dr. Zoccoli.
You see, this debate, I enjoyed it immensely because you are a tremendous speaker. And
even though I stutter.
The way you present your point is very convincing. You go through the audience. But I think that the position cannot be balanced and conceived. And the reason is that the question is philosophical, it's not medical. Your approach is entirely economical. I've read last year an illuminating book by a philosopher by Harvard, Michael Sandel. The title of the book is What Money Can't Buy. And the book is a long list of problems that modern medicine has. Economy can model everything, but there is a limit to economy. Human beings and mankind has always had values. The society is brought together thanks to values. You cannot sell values. And ensuring the best treatment to everyone, at least for Europeans, is a value.
I agree. And in economics, we make a choice between what's called positive economics, which is really if A, then B. And there is supposed to be no kind of values that I think A is better than B. I mean, when I talked of cost effectiveness in India, for example, the only criterion I'm saying is if the goal is to save lives, and you could save a lot more lives for the same dollar of making clean water supply, then you would do that rather than treat kidney failure. But I, as an analyst, I don't think I really have a right to bring a value to this. I mean, the value I bring in talking about these things is how can we make this program, which is focused on patients, how can we structure the financial incentives to do that in least cost fashion and to make the patients most happy for any given dollar? I think the really big philosophical question is how much should a society do for a dialysis patient? That's the tough that's the tough philosophical question. Ed Lowry one time said to me, if the price is high enough, I'll tuck the patient in bed at night. And, you know, I mean, we have this price, I mean, this system now, and you can't, I don't think you can say that Americans aren't generous. We have 550,000 people on treatment. And when I remember getting beat up in Europe at a meeting by the Dutch and talking about the uninsured in America and all this stuff, and you know, I mean, the ESRD program in America is an amazingly successful program. It has cut across all sorts of barriers that the rest of medical care hasn't achieved. The treatment rate of African Americans in the United States is five times that of whites. Five times, four or five. So it's a wonderful program. Could it be better for the given level of spending? That's where economics comes in and says, well, if you change this incentive or that incentive, you might get more out of the program. But how much we should put into treating dialysis patients, that's not an economic. I mean, I think I agree with you. That's a philosophical question. I mean, there are all sorts of things you could do for dialysis patients. By the way, one of the mentions in the earlier debate that I really wanted to jump on, I am told that a dialysis unit in the United States cannot pay a taxi fare for a patient. And that's because, I was saying all these regulations are out there, and there's this anti-kickback law. And besides the anti-kickback law, there's the Stark laws. And apparently, if a dialysis unit were to pay a taxi fare, it would be considered an inducement for the patient to come to the dialysis unit. Now, if that's not crazy, I don't know what is. But those are the kinds of things. But I totally agree with you that there are philosophical values here that economics not only can't, but shouldn't answer. I want to make one final comment. Nobody asked me who all those pictures were on the bottom of my first slide. I'll tell you in the bar.
Okay.